Imagine you drive for a living. You wake up, you open the app, and the app is closed to you. No call, no letter, no name at the bottom of anything. Yesterday you had a job. This morning a piece of software decided you don't. Now imagine that happened to 171 people in France, and they didn't accept it. Well, last Thursday, the Dutch Data Protection Authority published a decision fining Uber €825 million, about $966 million. It is the largest penalty ever issued under Europe's privacy law. And the reason is a single sentence spoken by the regulator's deputy chair. And I quote, "A computer should not make decisions on its own that have major consequences for you." We've spent the entire summer talking about rule books. And tonight, the rule book just got a price tag. Four segments. First, we're going to talk about what actually happened, the flag, the suspension, and the silence. The second is going to be around, we're going to fight over these three words, which is meaningful human involvement. And then the third is a much quieter number from the same last week about what AI is already doing to paychecks. And then the fourth, the American question. Because the drivers here are the same drivers, and the law here is not the same. So I'm Dr. Alan Badeau. This is AI Today. Welcome to our show. Now, let's start with what the regulators found, because the details are really the entire case. And, you know, so Uber's European headquarters, it sits in Amsterdam, right? That matters under the mechanisms and, you know, the GDPR called the one-stop shop. So whichever country hosts a company's European base becomes the lead authority for complaints from anywhere in the European Union. So a complaint born in Paris ends up in the desk at The Hague. The Dutch authority is called the authority to, well, let's just call it the AP because it's a very long word. This is though now the fourth time that it's fined Uber. Okay. So €600,000 in 2018, 10 million over drivers' privacy rights, $291 million in 2024 for shipping driver data to the United States without proper safeguards, and now €824,990,000. Crazy. But it's a figure that the AP calculated. It's really, you know, it's a fraction based on Uber's 2025 turnover is how they're assuming that it was calculated. But each one, though, has been larger than the last. And this is not a coincidence, right? That is the regulator learning that the first three didn't change behavior. So here's what the decision describes, though. Over a period, the AP places between 2018 and 2022, Uber ran systems that watched two things about every driver: how they drove and how riders rated them. Okay, makes sense. When those systems flagged a suspicion of fraud or a rating judged too low, the driver's account was deactivated. Not reviewed, deactivated. A temporary suspension then would follow the flag automatically. And the AP found that in some cases, permanent ones did too. That's the problem. No human in the middle, no explanation of what the system had seen, no clear path to argue with it. Again, a problem. Think about what those two inputs actually are. Driver behavior, it's telemetry, right? Acceleration, braking, route deviations, GPS anomalies, whatever, all those things in between. That's a rich signal. And in fairness, a legitimate one. Platforms have real fraud problems sometimes and real safety obligations. But the second input, the rating, that's something else. A rating is a stranger's mood, compressed to a single digit, entered in 4 seconds between the door closing and the next thing on their phone. Maybe they even forget it sometimes. We all do, right? But traffic, weather, the passenger's own bad day, none of it is the driver's, but all of it lands on the driver's fault, right? Stack enough of those and a threshold will trip. The system doesn't know that Tuesday's two-star rating was about a detour that the app itself chose. It knows only that the number went down. Now, you put those things, those two inputs into a pipeline with one output, deactivate, and you have built something that treats a fraud signal and a mood signal as the kind of evidence and knowledge that it needs to apply the same consequence. Whew. The complaint, though, didn't come from the regulator. It came from the drivers. 171 of them in France went to the human rights organization. The Ligue des Droits, right? De la Homme. I know I was awful pronunciation. I apologize for that. But in essence, the League took the case to France's privacy authority, and that is the CNIL. Now, because of the one-stop shop rule, the CNIL handed it over to The Hague. The same pathway produced the 2024 fine over the data transfers. Same drivers, same league, same route. They've been at this for years, and they've gotten pretty good at it. So I want to sit on that for a moment, because it's easier to hear regulator fines tech company and file it under Brussels versus Silicon Valley, okay? This is not that. This is a group of working people who lost income to a system that would not tell them why, and who found the one law in the world that says a machine is not allowed to do that to you alone. Now, the law is Article 22 of the GDPR, stripped of the legal grammar. Okay, I'm going to make this as simple as I can so I don't screw it up too. It says this: if a decision produces legal effects on you or affects you in a similarly significant way, it cannot be made by automated means alone. A human has to be genuinely involved, and you have to have a route to contest the outcome. Article 22 has been on the books since 2018, and its ancestor goes back even further, and that goes back to 1995 when, you know, there was a directive that says automated decisions meant a mainframe rejecting a mortgage application, for example. For most of its life, it was the quiet clause, right? Lawyers cited it, regulators mentioned it in guidance. Almost nobody was fined under it, though, but because almost nobody had built a system that truly decided alone. The human was always somewhere in the process, if only because the software wasn't good enough to be trusted without one. That's changed. The models got good enough to go beyond what the human was expected to have to do. And the moment the human became optional, the clause that had been theoretical for 20 years became a live wire. What's new isn't the law, though. What's new is that a regulator has now decided what costs to ignore it. Now, consider it from the driver's seat, okay? Because That's where the complaint began. You're not told your account is under review. You're told nothing. The app simply stops offering you work. You write to support, you get a template. You ask what you did, and you get a reference to the terms of service. Days pass, and for some, the AP found the days didn't end, right? There's no hearing because there was never a decision in the sense you'd recognize. There was a threshold, potentially, and you may have crossed it, but the system did what it was built to do. You can't argue with the threshold, though. It can only be on one side of it. Now, that silence, that's the second violation. And I'd argue, really, it's the one that made the first one even possible. Because, a company that has to explain the decisions, as it's building these systems, it's got to make sure that that capability is in there. And a company that doesn't, well, it just doesn't. So the AP's deputy chair, put it in a language that really no lawyer would use. And she said drivers were deactivated without pardon. From one moment to the next, they had no income through Uber. And that's forbidden. And then the line that followed this, really followed the case for years, actually, is that a computer should not make decisions on its own without having some sort of recourse, or if it's a major consequence to you, then it definitely shouldn't be made by a machine alone. Now, think about the scale, okay? Only one GDPR fine has ever been larger. And the 1.2 billion euros Ireland levied against Meta in 2023 over transfers of Facebook data to the US, right? Meta is, of course, still appealing that, and Uber has already filed its appeal here, but there's a pattern worth naming. Both of the two largest privacy penalties in history came from regulators in small member states that happen to host European headquarters of large American companies, Ireland and the Netherlands. Although they didn't set out to become the enforcement arms of the continent, they sure have. The one-stop shop made them that. Whether that's a feature or a distortion depends on what side of the desk you're on. Now, let me be precise about this and what was penalized, because the press coverage kind of blurs it a little bit. So the AP found two violations. One, the prohibition on solely automated decision making. Okay. Two, the driver's right to be informed. Those are separate failures. And you can make a decision the wrong way, and you can hide how you made it. Uber and AP's findings did both. And note what was not penalized, though. The AP did not rule that Uber can't use algorithms to detect fraud. It didn't rule that it can't be a part of the larger picture. It didn't say the model was wrong. It said the model was alone. That distinction is really the heart of tonight's show. So let me put it in terms that we've used on this program all year. A cognitive system, an agent, a model, a scoring engine can own the reasoning. It can watch the telemetry. It can do all those things. What it cannot do is act by itself. Okay? And that is what we're going to talk about in the rest of the show. So next, we're going to talk about Uber's answer. And it's a better answer than you'd expect, quite honestly, because when you say a human was involved, they may be telling the truth. The fight is over whether that human was there to decide or there just to nod. So stay with us. We'll be back after a few messages from our sponsors. So, I'm Alan Badeau. Welcome back to AI Today. Uber's response was fast and it was pretty firm. We strongly disagree with this decision and disproportionate fine. That's a spokeswoman to Reuters. And then the substance, most suspensions are brief, right? No permanent deactivation happens without human review. Drivers can appeal. And this is the part to underline. The company says it no longer makes permanent deactivation decisions solely through automated systems. Okay. So read those two statements side by side and you'll notice that they don't quite contradict each other. The AP says some drivers were permanently cut off with no person involved during the years that it had examined. Uber says that's not how it worked. Present tense. And disputes that it ever did. Between no longer and never is where the appeal is going to live. But I don't want to spend this segment on factual disputes. The court is going to, of course, settle without us. I want to spend it on the concept underneath. We're going to talk about whether Uber wins or loses. The concept is what every company deploying decision systems is going to be measured against. Three words, though: meaningful, human involvement. Now, Article 22 doesn't say a human must click a button. If it did, every company would install a button and hire someone to click it 400 times an hour. The law says that the human's involvement has to be meaningful, and that word has spent, years without a definition. Meaningful, such a baseline word, you think, right? But it's become so powerful now. The Dutch authority, they've circled it, right? Stamp, whatever you want to say, but that word is now circled because, in 2025, it ran a public consultation on exactly that. When does a human oversight of an algorithmic decision count as genuine? And this past April, it issued a draft guidance on what Article 22, what that explanation really contained and what a person is owed when they think, oh, geez, why did the machine decide this about me? So the Uber decision didn't arrive out of nowhere, okay? It's the first big enforcement action on a question the regulator has been thinking about and quite honestly out loud for over 2 years. That's usually how this works, though. The guidance comes first, it's quiet, nobody says anything, and then boom, case hits and it goes off like a bomb. Now, let me offer a way to think about meaningful that I use with our clients because it cuts through a lot of this legal fog, and we all know how we don't like legal fog, right? Ask three questions about a human in the loop, okay? One, could they see? Did the reviewer have access to what the system actually saw? The trip data, the rating history, the specific signals that triggered the flag, or did they see a summary that said fraud suspected, confidence high? No thresholds, no numbers, nothing else with it. If the person only sees the conclusion, they're not reviewing it. They're reviewing the font, maybe, or the color, or maybe there needs to be a button. but they're not reviewing it. That's not meaningful. Two, could they say no? Where or was or if there was a path for the reviewer's judgment to overrule the outcome or even reinstate the driver, for example. A reviewer who can only escalate is a reviewer who can only delay. That is not oversight. That's a longer hallway, right? More paperwork, more doors to go down. That's not the same. Three, did anyone ever say no? This is the one I think that decides cases, okay? If a company has a human reviewer step and that step has approved 10,000 deactivations and only reversed four, a regulator is going to ask what those 10,000 approvals were for. Were they a rubber stamp? Were they really a human in the loop? Is there any human decision even in there? That's the question. So, say C and did. I think that's really the test. And notice that none of those questions are about the model. They're about the room. Who's in the room? Who can raise their hand? Who can say no? Now, here is the honest complication, though, okay? There's a real argument on Uber's side that deserves a fair hearing, and I think it goes like this. And I'll paraphrase it a little bit, but fraud detection at platform scale cannot wait for a person, okay? It's all about speed to decision. If a system spots a pattern that looks like a stolen account or a coordinated scam, and you have a route every one of those, to a human before they can act, you've built a fraud machine with a human speed limit, okay? So the temporary suspension, the automatic pause, it might be a reasonable move. Stop the bleeding, then have a person look at it. We see it all the time with credit cards and, other banking account information and high transactional type data. It can be very important. It can be very beneficial to the end user, right? Now, I think that argument is right as far as it goes, okay? And I think a regulator would agree with that, up to a point, though. The finding wasn't that automated pauses are illegal. It was that the pause became the permanent, that the person didn't have a way to escalate that, and that the driver was really never told what happened or why it happened. A speed limit for fraud is one thing. A locked door with no one behind it is a completely different one. So, what does the right version look like? Now, I'm going to sketch it just to give you an idea, okay? Because it's not exotic, and I've helped build, a variety of these over the years. And it really is around system flags. Flag triggers a pause. Automatic, immediate, fine. The pause starts a clock. Inside of that clock are going to be three things that have to happen, and they've got to happen in this order. The person affected is told, not the model's internals, but the category of concern and what happens next. A named reviewer gets the case with the underlying evidence, not the summary. And the reviewer's decision, reinstate, extend, escalate, or terminate, is recorded with their name on it. And the affected person is told who that is. If the clock runs out before the human acts, the default is reinstatement. It cannot be termination. The system silence should cost the company, not the driver or the user. That last rule, though, is the one companies always resist. But it's the one that matters. If an unreviewed flag expires into keep them off, you've just made an automated decision permanent by neglect. If it expires into let them back in, you force yourself to staff the review. Because now the fraud risk of not reviewing is actually real. Defaults are policy. Whoever sets the default has decided who bears the cost of nobody showing up. The honest complication is the fine itself, though. A May analysis found that close to 40% of, the 7.1 billion euros in GDPR fines issued to date have been annulled or are currently under challenge. Reuters made the same point in its coverage when it had a headline that penalties against large tech companies routinely shrink on appeal, sometimes years later. So 825 million is a number on press release, but it's not yet a number on a balance sheet. Anyone who tells you this is settled hasn't read really the last decade of any of these cases. And that's interesting. But here's why I think that the numbers matter, even if it drops, okay? Because it probably will. Penalties do two things. They punish and they price. Even if the courts cut the fine in half, and let's or by three quarters, the market has now seen what a regulator believes a solely automated livelihood decision is worth. Every general counsel at every platform company in Europe read that figure last week, and every one of them asked the same question I'd ask. How many decisions do we make it that look like this? Yeah. Now, let's widen the lens a little bit, okay? Because this is not really about ride hailing. Think about where else a system decides alone, something that changes a person's week. A gig platform deciding who gets the next delivery, a lending model deciding whose application goes forward, a content system deciding a creator's channel and their channel is demonetized. Now, we talked about feeding the machine, right? A hiring funnel deciding which resumes a human oversees, right? And we can do this for years. We can talk about these. Every one of those systems has a temporary version and a permanent version. Every one of has flags and can act. And in every one of them, somebody built the pipeline and either put a real person between the flag and the act, or put a person-shaped step there and called it a review. That's the pattern. And, it's something that we're running into everywhere. Now, it does raise a quieter concept that we all need to think about. If the visible harm from algorithmic management is someone losing access to work, what about the harm that doesn't show up as a deactivation? What about the harm that shows up as a paycheck that just doesn't grow? That number came out last week again. So we're going to talk about that next. So stay with us. This is AI Today. We'll be right back after a few messages from our sponsors. Welcome back to AI Today. I'm your host, Dr. Alan Bedeau. And, you know, we talked about the Uber story and it is very loud, right? But, you know, €1 billion, a defined appeal, regulator, you know, quoting itself. You know, this next story, though, really almost made no noise. And I think, though, in the long run, it's really the more important one. So, Apollo Global Management is one of the largest asset managers in the world. Okay. Its chief economist, Torsten Slok, and colleagues, they published an analysis this summer that Slok walked through on Bloomberg over the weekend. They took 321 occupations, they sorted them. And it was by how exposed each one was to AI. And here's the interesting methodical choice. And it's, you know, not by theoretical index of could AI do this job, but by actual observed usage. The pair, they looked at, the Bureau of Labor Statistics data from 2015 to 2025 with Anthropic's economic index, right? And which tracks how people actually use Claude across occupations. They ran a standard difference in differences comparison and high exposure jobs versus low exposure jobs before ChatGPT and after. Yeah. Now, here's what they found. And in occupations highly exposed to AI, real wage growth after 2023 ran 6 percentage points slower than in low exposure occupations. And employment in those occupations, no statistically significant change. Now, let me say that in plain English. So far, AI is not taking the job. It's taking the raise. Interesting. Now, the part that should change how you hear every AI and jobs headline for the next year is this, that the effect was not evenly distributed. In the lowest paid quarter of occupations, the gap was 10.7 points. In the second quartile, 5.4. In the third, just 4. And in the top quartile, the highest paid work, there's no gap at all. Read that, and you'll see that the people who could least afford slower wage growth got most of it. The people at the top got none. Apollo's estimate of the aggregate cost to affected workers is about $28 billion a year. That's not lost jobs. That's really lost growth in the jobs that they kept. Now, I want to be careful because it's just one study. I always like to talk about the pros and the cons. And I've said on this program more times than I can count, right, that we're trying to be fair and give you the most information possible so you can make your own decision. So let me put Apollo's findings next to the other evidence, okay? And let you think about where it agrees and where it doesn't. So, you know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics looked at 18 AI exposed occupations and found employment down 0.2% in May of 2025, while overall payrolls rose about, 0.8. That's a small employment effect. It's not zero, but it's still small. Goldman Sachs economists said in May that fields highly exposed to AI, substitution saw job openings fall faster than in other fields. That's a hiring signal. That's not a firing one. Separate research cited by Forbes found starting wages at AI exposed companies fell 4.5 points after ChatGPT. And junior and mid-level pay really declined the most. Senior compensation was holding pretty steady. Now, at the Dallas Fed, though, back in February, they found something subtler, you know, even more still. On average, across 205 occupations, there was no relationship between AI exposure and post-2022 wage growth. But the average did hide a split, right? In occupations where experience earns a big premium, where the 20-year veteran makes far more than the rookie, AI exposure didn't hurt those wages. In occupations where that wasn't the case, it did. The tool seems to help the expert and substitute for the novice. So the picture, though, it's not unanimous, right? But look at what converges. Employment effects. Small, contested, hard to see. Wage effects. Present, concentrated at the bottom, concentrated among the junior staff. The apocalypse everyone warned about, mass displacement, it's just not showing up in the data. What's shown up is quieter and in some ways harder to fight. You can organize around a layoff. It's much harder to organize around a raise. So why would this be the shape? Let me try to offer a mechanism because I think it directly connects to segment one, okay? When a tool makes a worker more productive, there are two things an employer can do with that gain. They can either share it, which means pay the worker more because they now produce more, or they can capture it, hold the pay flat, keep the difference. Which one happens depends on bargaining power. And bargaining power depends on how replaceable you are. If AI has just made your task easier to do, easier for you, but also easier for someone else with less experience, or easier for the tool to do it itself, maybe next year, your leverage goes way down. And that's a trap. More productive, less powerful, same paycheck. Now, let me make it concrete, okay? Because that's what we like to deal with, okay? So you picture a customer, you know, support specialist at a mid-sized software company. Call it, you know, a $48,000 a year job, which puts it right around the boundary of Apollo's bottom quartile. 2 years ago, that person handled maybe 40 tickets a day. Now, an assistant drafts the first response, pulls the account history, suggests the fix. She handles now 90. Her output has more than doubled. So what happened to her pay? In the world where the gain is actually shared, she's now producing what two people produced, and her compensation moves toward that. She's producing, you know, so much more in a world where it's captured, the company notices it needs fewer people in the next hiring cycle, holds her raise to the cost of living, all of those things. The job still exists. The leverage is gone. Apollo's data says, you know, really the second world is the one we're in. And that's most true for exactly everyone being affected. Now you run the same pay exercise, you know, for a senior litigator, a principal engineer, a surgeon, whatever that is. You know, the assistant helps them too, but guess what? Nobody can be trained in their judgment in a week. Their scarcity survives. That's really what, you know, others are saying and how they're applying this. So, you know, many things here are connected, right? The Uber's drivers lost their income to a decision from a machine, and it made it alone. the workers in Apollo's bottom quartile are losing income to, you know, 1,000 decisions no machine made at all, right? Decisions about staffing, raises, and, you know, who gets promoted, made by humans, looking at a spreadsheet that now says the work takes less time. Different instrument, same symmetry, okay? In both cases, the system knows more about your value than you do. It's just not required to tell you. Now, here's something I want you to think about, okay? So wage suppression can be, you know, handled with AI. And that's an issue. And companies that are treating AI as that, you know, is that way, they'll get exactly the workforce though they deserve. The ones that treat it as a shared instrument will find out how good it can actually be. Both are going to show up in the data. Only one will show up in the data as growth, okay? So a €1 billion fine for the loud version of algorithm management, or, you know, and, you know, $28 billion a year for a quiet one. One of them has a law. The other has a chart. Both of them happen to a workforce that, you know, in this country has almost no protections that the French drivers used. Now, that's going to be our last segment. We're going to talk about the American question. So stay with us. We'll be back after a few messages from our sponsors. Welcome back to AI Today. I'm your host, Dr. Alan Badeau. And in this segment, our last segment, we're going to talk about, you know, really the differences in the GDPR and Article 22 and maybe what a driver in New York City has at, you know, their ability to handle these, you know, a situation that would be the same. I'm going to answer it honest as I can because it's less than most people would assume. But it is more than nothing, okay? There is no federal equivalent to Article 22 in the United States. There's no general right to be subject to solely automated decisions. No general right to be told when a machine decided something significant about you. What we have instead is really patchwork, you know, and that patchwork is old and narrow and mostly about money. In credit, we have something like it for decades though, right? But, you know, the Fair Credit Reporting Act and the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, you know, require an adverse action notice. If you're denied a loan, you're owed the specific reason. And the CFPB has said plainly that the algorithm did it. That's not a good reason. If a lender can't explain the model's decisions in terms of law that humans can recognize, the lender has a problem. The closest thing Americans have to really Article 22 only covers one kind of decision. Beyond credit, it's the states, the cities, and you know, the municipalities. New York City requires bias audits for automated tools used in hiring. Illinois amended the human rights law to reach AI in employment decisions just this year. California's privacy regulators have adopted a lot of rules around automated decisions and how those are going to impact its citizens. And Colorado passed the first comprehensive state AI law aimed at squarely, really, those consequential ones. the kind of that, you know, affect employment, housing, credit, insurance. Those are important. So the answer to what does American drivers have is it depends on the state, the decision, and the year, which is another way of saying there's no rule. They've got a map, but no rule. Now, let's look back across the Atlantic, okay? Because Europe didn't stop at Article 22, or Article 22. The EU AI Act, now we walked through this on the Rule Books and the Race show a while back, puts employment and workers and the management of them in the high-risk category. Systems that hire, fire, etc., you know, are all part of that. High risk means documentation. It means oversight. It means logging. It means the right to an explanation. Those obligations are slated to start biting this month. And Brussels has been arguing with itself about whether to delay them. Not surprising, right? Just like all other AI regulation that's out there. But I'll tell you, the direction's not in doubt. The Uber decision is what enforcement under privacy law looks like. And folks need to start paying attention to that. The AI Act is the same principle written for systems themselves rather than the data that they're running on. So you've got two laws, one idea. The machine may recommend, a person may decide, and the person's decision, though, it's got to be real. Now, I'll say something, though, that's aimed at any of the executives that are watching, because most of you aren't running a ride-hailing platform, and you might think that this doesn't reach you. It reaches you, trust me. Walk through an ordinary agentic pipeline, the kind I see in procurements that I'm building in claims, that, you know, in financial industries, in customer operations every single week. It in, you know, an intake agent reads the request, a retrieval agent pulls the policy, the contract, the account history. A reasoning agent scores it against the rules, drafts a determination. An execution agent posts the result to the system of record. Approved, denied, held, whatever. Four agents, one outcome. Elapsed time is under a minute. Oh, it's elegant. It's exactly what these systems are for. And if the execution agent can post denied to the system of record without a human touching the case, you've built Uber's pipeline with better branding. Yeah. Now, the fix isn't to slow the agents. It's to separate the last step. Everything up to the determination is the machine's work. It should be fast, should be thorough, and it should be tireless. The determination itself, the act that changes someone's account, someone's claim, someone's access, has to wait for a signature. Not a signature on every one. You know, that's the 400 clicks an hour trap that we talked about in segment two. It's a signature on every one that carries a significant effect, with the ordinary cases flowing through the system under a standing authorization a named person has accepted responsibility for and reviews. If you're deploying agents, and I'll tell you, most people are, whether the vendor calls them, you know, or not, ask yourself a simple question about every agent that can produce a consequence, not a recommendation, a consequence, approve or deny, suspend or reinstate, root or reject, or fast track or flag. For each one, who signs it? Now, it doesn't matter who built it, not who's on the log. Who's the named human with the authority to say no? Who saw the system? saw what was going on at least once. And, you know, if the answer is the system signs it, you've just found the decision that a regulator, a plaintiff, or a journalist will eventually find for you. And after last Thursday, you know roughly what it's priced at. Now, let me give you, I'm going to give you four things that the layer has to do, okay? Yes, four this time and not three. Because human in the loop, it's a slogan for many people, and oftentimes it's not, you know, really concrete, we'll say. So first is identity, right? Every consequential action has to carry a name. Simple as that. Second, evidence. The authorizing human saw what the system said. A form, a person, something that can be actually read. And this, you know, there's a suggestion that has a number with it. Third, it's got to be a refusal. The human can say no, simple as that. And it has to happen every once in a while to make sure that the system is actually being monitored, not just a rubber stamp. And then fourth, it's got to be record. Every yes and every no is kept with its reasons in a form you could handle and hand off to a regulator so that they can review it. A court, a person, whoever, it's got to have all that information in there. Identity, evidence, refusal, and record. Build those four things into your system and you have a proof of authority layer. You skip any one of those and you've got a log that describes what happened to somebody written by the thing that did it. And that's not going to work. Now, this is where I've landed after, you know, many years building these types of systems. And I want to say it as plainly as I can. Okay. Again, the agent owns the reasoning. We know that. It can read faster than you, correlate wider than you, hold more context than you, and it will only get better, you know, at all three as it learns. Let it. That's what it's for. But the act, the signature that turns a recommendation into somebody's Tuesday morning, belongs to a person with a name. Not because the machine can't be trusted, but because trust, it's not the point. It's about accountability. And accountability is not a property a system can have. It's a property the person should have. We call that a proof of authority layer on a chain of command system. Sounded like architecture then, right? A regulator just wrote it into an enforcement order with 9 zeros attached to it. So let me leave the ledger where it belongs, okay? On one side, the fine's going to shrink probably. Appeal's going to take years. A company that may be describing its present accurately, okay, it's all fair. On the other, the principal, maybe it won't shrink. A machine flagged a driver. The flag became the act. Nobody was there to catch it. And the law said for the first time at this scale, that the empty chair is the violation. Every system you run has a chair like that. The question isn't whether, you know, the model is good enough to sit in the chair alone. The question is who is going to be sitting in there as a person. And somebody's finally asked that. So that's the show. You know, again, full episodes are on demand at Now Media TV. But again, before I go, wardrobe tonight, as always, it's Canali. Okay. They've dressed this show since the beginning. If you ever wondered how I look, you know, put together after four segments under studio lights, well, that's the answer. It's Canali. Everything I have, on this show and Probably 90% of my personal clothes are from the store because I enjoy it and just love them. So thank you for being here this week. I'm Dr. Alan Badeau. Remember, sign your decisions, okay? Sign all of them so you don't have the same Uber scenario. I'll see you next week. Thanks for watching. Bye-bye.